Well, it's time for us to begin our study tonight. Well, let's go ahead and get settled in. That's not what I was looking for. Before we get into our time together and study, though, let's and bow our heads together in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the time we are privileged to share together tonight. It's our hope that as we study, that you enrich our hearts with an understanding of your word, that you strengthen our faith, and you give us the time we need to grow to be stronger and more zealous servants. Please forgive us of our sins and watch over our souls. In this prayer we offer in your Son's name. Amen. All right. In some ways, this feels like it's been a little while since we've had this study. In other ways, it really hasn't been as long as it feels like. But I know that with the middle period of time that we had that great gospel meeting with Bill, that our minds have probably been focusing on that subject and the related aspects of it, particularly if you're like me, where you hear a lesson, hear a sermon, and then it basically echoes in your head for quite a while afterwards, especially one that's so compacted with all the other lessons that were tied together with it. That being the case, it might be good for us then to kind of ease gently back into the text a little bit by looking at some of the overall themes in all of this story of God's people. Couple quick questions for you. I've said it a bunch of times. Let's see if it's stuck at least, some of these things. In the Torah, the Hebrew rendering of the Old Testament, how do they refer to the text of Numbers? What do they call it? In the wilderness. Okay. Now, does that help you remember really easily what really is the heart of the book? Yeah. And if you, and this is the point I make. This is why it works for me. It may not work for you. If I took a 12-year-old and said, I want you to read Numbers, or I want you to read In the Wilderness, which book are they going to pick? Pretty much all 12-year-olds are not going to pick Numbers. They're going to pick In the Wilderness. A lot of times, our perspective or our enthusiasm for a subject or an idea hinges on the titles we give it, the layers and labels that we give something. So if I said, hey, I think we need to have a budget meeting, how many people are really excited about that? Everyone's like, nope. Hey, let's have a spending plan meeting. Hey, what are you talking about? There's some interest there, right? The reason I highlight that is because if we think of the first five books of the Old Testament and only use descriptions that are the ones that kind of feel like 50-pound sledges and weights bearing down on our shoulders, then that's how we're going to think about the contents of the book. We're going to think about it as some hugely, horribly awful, no good, worst experience ever, when that's nothing at all what's inside any of these. Even the broadly named future books that we'll look at, like Joshua, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, those are really vague ways that we refer to them compared to the true depth of the content that's in there. So, we've got them listed for us a second ago, and they're kind of visible up here on the edge to a certain degree. But you think about what is in each of these books that will lead us to Deuteronomy eventually, but right now we're in the wilderness of Numbers. Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus. Each of them, as independent writings of God, have big ideas. So what's the big idea for Genesis? Like the most important thing you could say, if I needed to remember something from Genesis, This is the thing I want to remember first. Creation. My mind goes to beginnings, because there's a whole lot of beginnings. The beginning of creation, that's there. The beginning of sin. The beginning of God's people. The beginning of the nation, because there's a little bit different between God's people and the nation. A lot of seed prophecy. That is not just the seed prophecy, but like he's laying out the whole big forest that will follow. That all comes up in Genesis. First families. Beyond that, we go to Exodus. That one should be easy. What's the big thing about Exodus? The Exodus, right? But if you think about the conflict of Exodus, it's not just, yeah, I'm done here, we're out. That's not really the big thing. Nor is it even the physical movement of the people of Israel out of Egypt. Because remember the conflict between Jehovah and the false gods of the Egyptians. And the conflict between Moses and Pharaoh. Because they have a very complicated and connected relationship too, right? On one level, they are some level of family. But on another level, there's a family separation there that's massive. And there's that key phrase that really highlights this conflict. Who is the Lord that I should obey His voice? That's really the key conflict for this Exodus. Because you think of what the story would have been like if the Pharaoh had said, He is the Lord. I will obey His voice. Whole different outcome because the conflict shifts to a different area. But it didn't do that. Once you have that high pressure, and you had God's plan coming to fruition. So that gives us, through the Exodus, which is Exodus, and then Leviticus, another kind of oddly named book when we think about it from the English standpoint, but not so much when we look at the bigger picture of it. Because what is the big thing for Leviticus? You're going to look and say, here it is, this is the big detail, this is the big matter. Yeah, all that has to do, and I kind of centralize it to the regulation of worship, making worship regular. Because remember, these are all first-timers. These are people who, from their beginning, did not worship this way. With the Exodus, were brought out. And then they had to learn how to worship God. How do we do this? And when they tried to do it on their own, were they any good at it? Their own self-motivated worship ended up veering off into gullies, ditches, and who knows what. And there's that great, big, powerful phrase that was earlier in their experience. Well, we just threw it in the fire, and out came this golden calf. There it was. So that kind of gives us a highlight of some of these things that bring us to this point of God bringing them out and making worship regular for them. Regular in the sense of a standard. Regular in the sense of a practice that was consistent. Regular in the sense of Him giving a covenant with them that He kept. And one point that's really powerful that you might see throughout all of these first five books, man struggles to keep his end of the covenant. Yes or no? Yes. How consistent is God in keeping His end of the covenant? Consistent and lenient. Lenient in the sense of forgiving. Graciously calling them back. Sometimes through the petition of someone like Moses. Other times because his heart feels great compassion for them, independent of a request, a plea, a desire being expressed. In the text of Numbers or the wilderness here, we've already gone through parts 1 through 3 of 5 that kind of break out the book, where they get ready. And what are they getting ready for here in Numbers? What's their big, we're going to go do this thing? We're going to live the land. We're getting ready. And it is like a huge pep rally toward the end of that process as a way to kind of think of the key events that you go from the beginnings to the Exodus to the regulation of worship or regular worship of God to the introduction of numbers, and now they're going to get ready to go. Remember how they arrayed all of Israel and you had them all lined up with their standards and they're about to go out and you have that big, in essence, here we're about to go, and they step out. And then I've described it earlier as bouncing off of Canaan. It didn't actually bounce off. They drew back. You know, it's like, oh, we can't. There's massive armies there. Yeah, there's a lot of milk and honey. And yeah, God's promise would truly be there. But we can't take them. We do not possess the strength or the might to go up against that. And that bitter root of fear pretty much sets them on the stage to mark time. Anyone ever serve in the military or do marching band stuff? You know what just wears you out? Marking time. And you know that there's not going to be like an end to it. If you've done a long parade, and they're like, all right, and you're like, oh. Like that's the inner voice of every marching band member when you're in a long parade and the car in front of you decides to kind of inch along. You're going to just kind of inch along with them. It's going to wear you down. God protects them, but yet that's also part in that process of marking time, if you will, part of their educational process. It's interesting that the Bible makes this crossroads of ideas that discipline, instruction, education, and to a certain degree what we would call punishment all meet at the same crossroads. Well, you got to take your punishment, take your lumps, right? Why do you take your lumps? Why would you take your punishment? Because you earned it, right? But why is punishment given? Just because the person disciplining you is a mean person? It's incorrect. It's a corrective attempt. And actually, Jesus and the Hebrew writer and the Father and the prophets and the wise men of the Old Testament give us an insight that a loving Father disciplines to give lumps. So at our four-corner intersection, discipline comes in. It meets instruction. It occurs with education because they're all part of the same thing. But we don't often eat the meal thinking that it's the same thing. Because discipline doesn't feel good at all. Like it's literally not supposed to feel good. That's kind of the point when we get it. But afterwards, does it? It yields a fruit that you didn't know it was going to give to you. It produces in you something far different than the reception of it was like. And we see this with children, right? If you've worked with children with verbal discipline, not even your own, and you tell them, hey, let's try it a different way. And they try to do it in the same way again. Oh, wait. No, we're trying it differently, remember? And gradually with words, you can correct their behavior. You realize you're doing basically the same thing. You've told them no, gently. And you might have to use the big firm no. But that's a form of discipline. And that no, especially to an emboldened and stubborn heart, kind of feels like a spank. And you can see it in the kid's behavior too. And then you see it in adult behavior too, right? Someone tells you no as an adult. Like, wait a minute, I'm a grown up. You're not going to tell me no. I tell me no. Right? That's how our grown up minds work. But discipline, and that whole spectrum of intersections aligns itself there. And so in this section, we had a kind of a reconnection with their understanding of worship of God. God is helping them really keep a clear picture of whom He has placed at the leadership junctures in their life. And remember, it's not just Moses and Aaron who are solidified at this time. Those who would be serving with them, they're often brought into the same view. Some of those who were serving with them as types of leaders were some of the problems, and they were dealt with as well. And so that had all taken place all the way through chapter 18 and the introduction of the 19th chapter, where you have a reiteration of some of the specifics for purification, like in chapter 19, verse 11, whoever touches a dead body of any person shall be unclean 7 days. And so they once again kind of reconnect to that big expectation that God's people are going to be a holy people. God's people are going to be led by His chosen officiants. And God's people are going to follow His plan. That would have been part of their failure up to this point. His chosen plan, take Canaan. His chosen leaders, Moses and Aaron, had sent spies. And some of those leaders had failed. Some of those spies had failed to come back with a report that matched God's plan. Their fear or whatever else drove them away from the potential of God's rescue and God's care. Which brings us right to chapter 20. Kind of brings us right to where we need to be for tonight. Chapter 20, verse 1 begins, "And the people of Israel, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed in Kadesh, and Miriam died there and was buried there." It's interesting, a couple of things we need to kind of connect with. Moses, and to a lesser degree Joshua, have their hands in the arrival of this written record. Because Moses is credited as being the author, but Joshua certainly has a part. You can see that in the way that the dialogue takes place. In the midst of the way in which God has these things lay out, in the first part of this chapter, say verses 1 all the way through verse 9, and even all the way down into verse 12, Moses himself is going to go through the other end of a person's life in ways that are pretty painful. You think about this, verse 1, verse 2, and so on. There's loss in his immediate family. The complaints from those who surround him continue in verse 2. He's frustrated because of a rebellious spirit. The acceptance of the reality that neither he nor his brother will enter the promised land. Moses is shown to us, especially this more mature Moses, as being a sensitive human being. Someone who is moved by compassion for his people, willing to serve to the extent of every ounce of himself, and yet still humble before his God and mighty in the presence of all. Now, he's a pretty complicated guy, yet he's not perfect. We see some of that too. So this introduction here is a pretty powerful look to the reality that in life everything can seemingly be going great, as it was as they entered into the last phase to take the promised land. And then in the beat of a couple hearts, turn in an entirely different direction and have all new outcomes, things that were completely unplanned for. Even more so, verses 14 to 21, we're going to note that the direct route that they may have been intending for is now going to cause them to go through a nation that really is not happy with their presence. So all of this has kind of been a series of crises in the midst of his leadership. If you go back through history, and let's just take U.S. history for a second. How many U.S. presidents had the entire period of their presidency without war? Very few. In the entire history of our nation, we have spent like 70 to 80% of it at war, like declared or otherwise. And actually, the amount may even be higher than that. I think it's like 100 and... I'm doing the math in my head really quickly. It's closer to 90%. That translates to every president, for the most part, had a period of their presidency where their troops that represented their nation, that they were the legitimate head of, were at war. How old is our nation? Okay, more math. Come on, no math. Yeah. All right, so you just think about the impact of that. Here's Israel. How old is their nation? Got to put it in context here. You know, not long at all, by comparison. Have they had any peaceful times? For real? Like, lots of peace? Not really. Not a whole lot of peace. In fact, either internally or externally, the entire time of Moses' leadership of these people, there's been conflict. Significant conflict. Even though there is a place of rest promised to them. Every ounce of their steps seems to be another rock to climb, another spear pointed our way, and another failure to arrive at their table. Almost all of the records of Moses' leadership points in the text have to do with basically bad times. Look through the wilderness, Numbers, and look through Exodus, and find the time frames that are really awesome. They're basically when God's hand is present. And they're like, whoa, God's here. Like, that's their basic position. You can kind of see their behavior when God's power is displayed, when the waters are moved out, when His messengers come to aid them, and so on. And so this transitionary text here kind of gives us hint to the reality of most lives. We tend to think that our lives are going to be super peaceful, especially when we're young, right? Peace combined with personal excitement. What does God tell us to pray for? And this is the balance, kind of make application quickly of this first part of chapter 20. What does God tell us in regards to our time on this earth to pray for? Like, literally say, go pray for these things. Not that we actually pray for, but what did He tell us to? Any of the epistles talk about prayer? Like, go pray for this. Pray for wisdom. How about a peaceful life? Why should we pray for a peaceful life? It makes it easier for us to be faithful, right? Here's a connection. If we're instructed through the apostles an inspired message to pray for a peaceful life, I want to think that that means we need it. Like, we need to be praying for it, because in absence of prayer, what's the opposite? No peace. That's the connected concept. That they lead us to peace. Because again, it makes our lives in Christ and in God more richly possible in the big sense of comfort that comes from God, spirituality that comes through His Word, and effective service in the vineyard, in the harvest. And so looking at these kind of sections of the Old Testament text, particularly here as we get into verse 2, where it's that term, the waters of Meribah, which is a key point that the Bibles will connect in other places. Remember that in both the structural national side, but think about it in your own life. As much as turmoil produces patience, because it does eventually. If we endure through turmoil, it produces patience. How many of you afterwards would have liked to have a little peace in the middle of that? All of us would have. So it's a great way to kind of think of this on a personal level and on the macro level here. So let's read verses 2 through 9 right now. We've kind of highlighted them a little bit. I want to turn back now and dig into them specifically. Matt, could you read that for us, please? Verses 2 through 9 of chapter 20. You know, think about just verse 8 and verse 9 there is right there. So on the heels of laying to rest a beloved family member, they go back to the standard behavior of professional complainers. And that's how we sometimes look at this Israel, like the experts. But then we have to remind ourselves that we and them, they and us, are a whole lot more alike than different. And our complaint level is probably not that different. Especially because ours aren't written down in the book for everyone else to read. So that's probably part of the disconnect there. Paul mentions this, actually, and that's where the tie-in comes. He wrote to the Corinthians that he did not want his listeners to be ignorant of the fact that during this time, the Lord had been abundantly generous to these people, to these families, providing food, water, clothing, protection, leadership, power, and opportunity. If you look through, say, the Sermon on the Mount and all the things that God promised through Christ and the Beatitudes, or in the latter section of that book in chapter 6, the specific connection to the birds of the air, the lilies of the field, how they were arrayed, He cares for us that way. He does so in absence, by the way, of a very codified covenant in that sense. We are not physical Israel. He doesn't provide those things for us because He's entered into a personal covenant with us, and if we keep it, He keeps it. Out of His grace. Out of His abundance. He says, I've taken care of you. For Israel, though, it is part of their covenant. It literally is that God will care for them, like spelled out, and then they had a practice of that taking place. And yet in the midst of that, disapproval comes pretty easy for them. We don't like your leaders. We don't like your ways. We're sick of this manna, the quail. Oh, I'm done with that. This land you say to go get, we can't take that. When Paul brought up this illustration to the Corinthians, it was intended as kind of a spear. Because look at your behavior in comparison to theirs. So quickly, what kind of things had the Corinthian brethren received from God that Paul needed to bring this story to the table? What kind of care were they receiving from Him? All the same things. Not necessarily on the physical plane on the first level, but spiritual care. He refers to them, 1 Corinthians 5, such were some of you. The first big thing that they had was their real transformation. When he says you were, but now are, Paul's writing and telling them, this without God, this is who you were. But in Christ, this is who you are. Especially when you connect it to the last sections of chapter 15 and the bigger picture of that. They'd all been adopted into the family of God. They had been placed on an equal plane with the Son of God. And now He's reminding them of this kind of bitter root, the waters of Meribah, that kind of complaint model of approach, particularly to a group that actually turned inward in their complaints. Because who were the Corinthians complaining about? Not really Paul. Not really God. Each other. One would go to the Lord's Supper. Some would have lots. Some would have little. Some would go first. Some would go later. They would shame those who had not. Oh, I can speak in tongues. So my gift that God has given me is so much better than yours. All you can do is blah, 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 blah. but not like my clinging symbol. I'm the best. That was their behavior toward one another. And that's great that Paul brings this particular illustration back up for us, because that's something that we, and I'll say plainly as Americans, as Christians who struggle in America, probably need to hear a little bit more often. And you'll see that here in this text, the connectedness back to the text here in Numbers 20. The anger and the frustration of Israel is being directed back to Moses, to Aaron, to the servants that God had placed in those roles. And they had kind of forgotten who they were serving, like who they really were complaining against. Raise your hand if you're excited to go to the DMV. Right? None of us are excited to go to the DMV unless you just turned 15 or 16. And then you're probably the only people who are excited to go to the DMV. You ever seen a really happy employee there? Do you think those folks have happy lives? I've actually known some who've worked there. You know, they don't like dealing with us as much as we don't like dealing with them. How much control do you think they have over how they do their job? This is an illustration that I think we can all get real quickly. Zero. Like literally, they have none. They have a book. They got to follow it. If they don't follow it, they lose their job. It's like literally that simple. And if you don't make the check boxes, they say, go back in line. Do it again. Or whatever the answer is. You do that enough with enough grumpy people, you're going to kind of close off. Moses and Aaron, Miriam, all the other Joshua servants of Israel at times are servants for God who do not necessarily control their own destiny because they've chosen to serve. That was the choice they made. And we even praise Joshua for that, right? What did Joshua say? As for me and my house, I will serve the Lord. Okay, he served the Lord. That meant he did what God said. That meant he went where God told him to go. So he submitted himself to the role of service. Well, when you complain, you're in part complaining against the one who actually leads and the one who actually guides. In this case, it's God through. Secondly, in this context here, by this time, we'd already remember number 16, that God was not pleased with Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And his judgment at that point was expressed in earthquake, fire, and plague. They were treating the Lord with contempt. And now the same people, through a period of elasticity of time, what does it say, verse 3? And the people quarreled with Moses and said, "What, or would that we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord." It would have been better if I just died then than to still be out here now. It's like they've forgotten who they're talking to. The emotional aspect is taking God, who is a capital G God, and treating him like he's a little g God. Is there a difference in our Bibles in the way that they write that for a reason? Yeah, the Bibles do a pretty good job of helping us figure out one or the other. Because a little g God, I don't really have to listen to, right? And actually, I shouldn't. God in this world, don't need to listen to him. Gods of men, don't need to listen to them. But the big g God is a big deal. What's being highlighted here is their attitude is, it would have been better to have been then than to still be doing this. Does that make sense to us as we read the text? Like, do I understand the plight of the Israelite? Seems weird to me. Like, why would they feel like it'd be better to have died? Because how bad would it feel to say that out loud in your prayers? Because that's really what they're, in essence, doing when they speak to Moses, speak to Aaron. They're saying, God, it would be better if you just killed us then. Do we sometimes struggle to accept God's punishments? Or accept God as the mighty God that He is? Do we ignore His Word? Acting like no big deal? I think if we're honest with ourselves, we've probably run that ravine more than once. Do we understand there's not a difference between those of Numbers 20 verse 3 and you and I if we do the same thing? Wait a minute, I wasn't there. I know. But if I act the same way or treat God the same way, and it's not about a congregational issue, it's not about a family issue, it's a me and God issue. And how do I respond if He tells me something is sinful and I look at it and go, I'm not so sure. He tells me something is unholy and I'm like, yeah, but it looks really good. I mean, everyone else is doing it. All the other places, all the other people I know, they're doing this, whatever. I mean, it doesn't really matter. It could be fornication. It could be adultery. It could be lasciviousness, licentiousness, lust, greed, envy, strife. All the things that are like bold letters specifically spelled out. But it could be something as simple as Romans chapter 14, and I forget how I should look to the brother for whom my Lord also died. And there's no difference in the two of those. By the way, what's the context of Romans 14 just for our perspective? I know the answer because I bring up the verse and I plan for it. Initial context is personal judgment in regards to holy days, eating of meats, and how we treat one another around some of those aspects, right? Like, if we have conscience that is developing at different rates and we're building ourselves and maybe someone is convicted that they just can't give up the Sabbath just yet, as an illustration. That was a first century issue. Like, I can't. I know that the Sabbath is done away with the old law, but I just can't. Well, the illustration in context is your brother whom you're looking at, the Lord died for him too. And in the end, it closes off with the context of you can have your conscience and be engaged in Saturday activities, as an illustration, or eating a meat that was sacrificed to idol and not sin. But you also can't treat it like your brother over there is sinning because his conscience moved in a different direction. And furthermore, you should learn to work together and be able to harmoniously participate in worship and actually be a non-issue. Certainly more study and growth will take place over time, but that's not the point. It actually never deals with that secondary issue of studying through it. It deals with the now issue of our hearts, the now issue. So again, go back to the text where you have these complaining attitudes and you can see how judgment, personal judgment, actually does come into play. That's why it's a great text to kind of tie in, because those folks were looking at Moses and Aaron and going, I could do better than that. That's the motivation side. We'd already have Canaan if I was in charge. That's the attitude that underlies the spirit of discord. But as long as Moses is in charge, we're going to be marking time out in the desert, out in the wilderness. That's the conflict that underscores that big push, that big pressure on them. And in the end, Moses is dealing with a circumstance of great family loss and then has to deal with a group that despises the generosity of God. Because that's where the attitude finally ended up at. Tim? Yeah. And the connection I'm thinking through my head is this. Think about even Moses in that role. Have you ever had a bad day at work or out in the field or on a project, and then you get home and the kids have misbehaved or the animals have misbehaved or nothing works right at the house, the power's out, your stew you had on the pot is done for, and on top of that, let's add five more things went wrong, and you snap at somebody because of all those things that happened up to it? Can we be generous towards Moses a little bit too and kind of understanding his perspective as well? So, for the flock of Israel, or the physical, earthly communicator of Israel, and even seeing God's vantage point a little bit, when we're looking at things, just like a physical Israel might be, and thinking about what do we have to live for, what's driving us, what's our weight, why are we so full of sorrow? Make sure that we're compassionate to both edges of the extreme, for both those who lead and to those who serve. The easiest illustration is that day you go to the grocery store and you see that kid misbehaving and that mom just about ready to explode. We don't know what else happened. More than likely, what she really needs is someone to help her shop. Because if you've never tried to shop recently with two or three little kids, I vaguely remember it's more of an adventure than a destination. Tim. Yeah, she had two heads. I don't know if we had a steadfast rule. I can't remember that. I don't think that ever happened in our house. But I know more often than not, at least now on the other end of the spectrum, the kids get forced into service. And so now they're paying for their earlier behaviors. What do you think about that on the bigger picture of things and how there's an interaction between the sheep and the flock and their relationship to one another and how they can kind of stress and bind? Well, that's for all of us. We've got just a little bit more in content to conclude this first part of chapter 20. But unfortunately, the clock says it's 7:44. So we've got to stop right here and apologize for not getting as far as I wanted to. But now we're back into it. So Sunday morning, we'll definitely finish chapter 20. Try to keep these thoughts on the top of your head. We're really trying to intertwine this message with practical connection to the New Testament. Thanks, everybody.